back and they're at it again. I had to physically separate the two of them in the studio here.
Well, I had to show them to their chairs, actually. Maybe not physically separate them. Bob Metz and Jeff Schlemmer, nice to see you again, guys.
And you.
I missed you last week. I actually thought about you on Wednesday. At that point in time, I was interviewing a government guy, and I actually flashed for a second that right now the guys are back there with Ed and doing the left, right, and center. You had a good time last week?
Yeah, it was fun.
Did Eddie took good care of you?
Certainly
he
did.
Good. Today, you are prepared to discuss, I understand, Linda McQuaig's new book, The Cult of Impotence. Now, I haven't read the book, but I've interviewed Linda a couple of times. I'm familiar with the premise of the book. I've read some of the reviews of the book. Essentially, she's saying that we have deluded ourselves, or our leaders have deluded themselves, or our leaders have attempted to delude us by suggesting that there is such a thing as global imperatives economically, that the global culture, global trade cannot be ignored, that no country can resist this globalization, that we are at the mercy of the markets, and that we must make our decisions based on the needs and wants and desires of the marketplace. And that any country who doesn't do that is going to be doomed to economic second-class citizenship. Am I right so far, Jeff?
Yep.
Okay. Robert, I'm going to ask you, since Jeff agrees with what I said was right, what's wrong with her premise? I mean, certainly we have kind of kowtowed to this, can I use the word ephemeral sense of global? Nobody really knows what globalization really means economically. We're not sure even what the rules are yet. We don't know how suddenly in the last 10 years globalization has become, it's become the buzzword. Many people aren't, we don't understand that. What's wrong with her premise? She says we don't have control. Do we have control?
Of course we do. To suggest that we're at the mercy of the markets is a contradiction in terms. We are the market. So we're at our own mercy, so to speak. It's a meaningless sentence. The global imperative has always been there. Every person on the face of this planet wants to survive. And they want to survive in the best way possible, and something that suits their choice and lifestyle. When we talk about globalization, we're talking about all of us on this planet living under a common set of rules and principles, and that the battle today is over what those rules and principles shall be. And from what I know of Linda McQuaig's argument here in The Cult of Impotence is that she thinks that the whole answer to everything is we need more democracy, that we can vote ourselves into prosperity. And I just don't think that's possible. If it were, we would have done it a long time ago.
Well, Jeff, what's wrong with that premise?
Well, the key problem is that, and she basically goes through the history of the Liberal government since they were elected in 1993, and at the time they had said that their key promise to Canadians was that they were going to reduce unemployment. They were elected in the middle of the deepest recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s. But shortly after they got into government, there's another book called Double Vision that also documents this. Paul Martin was persuaded by the Ministry of Finance that unemployment was not the big bad thing to worry about, but that the deficit was, and that everything had to take second a backseat to the deficit, including unemployment. And in fact, he was persuaded that high unemployment is necessary for prosperity in the modern economy. And that goes back to Milton Friedman's ideas about a natural rate of unemployment, and that is that the worst thing that can happen in an economy is inflation, and inflation is caused by rising wages, effectively, and rising wages are caused when unemployment is low and employers have to pay employees more money to keep them working. And the theory goes that you have to have unemployment that is fairly high in order to keep people uncertain enough about their jobs that they won't ask for raises. And in fact, what's happened in Canada in the latter part of the 90s is, of course, the recession ended. We got back to economic prosperity about theoretically 3 years ago. Since that time, we've seen huge profitability. We've had the banks posting record profits each year. Corporate salaries have gone through the roof each year. The stock market has been at record levels, the TSE, for 6 years now. And what's happened is that there's been huge inflation, if you like, in the value of stocks and bonds. The value of them has gone up dramatically. And the only way that you can have basically a flat line on inflation when that's happening is that you have to have deflationary pressure on wages. Because essentially inflation is a measure of what things cost to buy. But the measure of what things cost to buy is determined by how much people have to spend. Pay more money to buy stuff. And we've seen, for instance, right now that it takes it's a year and a half waiting list to get a new Mercedes 4x4, that for people at the upper end of the market, there's a huge amount of purchasing going on. So where you've got that, that would create inflationary pressure, but for the fact that wages have remained flat. And in fact, when you take into consideration that there is some inflation, in fact, the average earning power of the average middle-class person in Canada today is significantly less than it was 8 or 9 years ago. So what she says is that Paul Martin was persuaded that he had to fight the deficit in order to keep inflation down, that inflation was the worst bugbear in the Canadian economy, and as a result of that, decided to let unemployment go. And you may recall that he had set tight deficit targets and said, I will meet these deficit targets, and in fact, he met them ahead of schedule. But on the question of unemployment, the Liberal government has always said, we will not be pinned down to any number. You know, inflation will hopefully come down at some point down the road, but it really hasn't very much, considering we're 3 years into a boom economy.
She talks a lot about democracy, and the Canadian people, I think, as an observer, I would like to think a modestly informed observer, the Canadian people have supported the policy. The Canadian people do not want the federal government to create jobs. We haven't seen that, and traditionally
the government
that,
can't create
well,
jobs.
But you know what I'm saying.
That's a physical impossibility.
But you know what I'm saying, Robert. They can put people on a payroll. And governments in the past have done that. They have put people on a payroll. Our democracy, Canadians don't want that to happen.
Oh, yeah, and she hasn't suggested that either. She hasn't suggested that the way to prosperity is by having government hire everybody. But what she's saying is that the interest rate policy of the government determines how well or unwell the economy is, and that back in the late 80s, when John Crow was the governor of the Bank of Canada, he decided as an experiment, and it was endorsed by a number of economists at the time, to try to kill inflation for all time, and the way he did it was by raising interest rates far higher than they were in the United States. The thinking is that he overkilled the Canadian economy and left it in much worse shape. Mm-hmm. Bankruptcies were at record levels, and our recession was much worse than their recession was.
But one of the
reasons, only slowly climbing out of that now.
One of the reasons to set those interest rates higher in the U.S. at the time was to attract investment to this country. If people invested in this country, that would create jobs. That would create all the productivity and opportunity that you want to see.
But what happened
the
in fact
was
the government
got
into a deep recession, though.
Right, because the government was inflating the currency and spending like crazy. You know, Milton Friedman, by the way, never said that it's inflation versus unemployment. What he said was that you will have unemployment as a natural consequence of either beating inflation or allowing inflation to run amok. It works on both ends of the scale. You're going to have unemployment as a side effect. It has nothing. It's not a cause and effect. It's just it's a side effect of changing markets, changing systems, people moving from one area of activity to another. So, you know, Linda McQuaig's talking about we can have full employment. I don't know what she means by that. What's the rate of full employment, 100%?
Well, if you look at the United States, you have an example where their unemployment rate right now is about 4%. It's less than half of what ours is. And again, her thesis is that a reason for that is that they didn't push the inflation button nearly as hard, and that the American government had chosen not to raise interest rates as far to try and kill
and yet the American
inflation.
Government has still mounted an attack on deficit spending. I mean, they've been pretty aggressive down there too.
Well, yeah, and I say it's not just a question of the deficit, it's also a question of where you set your interest rate. That is, the higher you set your interest rate, the more you dampen down the economy. The higher interest rates are, the harder it is for people to borrow money for investment and so on, and the sicker the economy
gets.
But
you know, our interest rates in this country have been at record, the real interest rate, the difference between the rate of inflation and the nominal interest rate, have been at record lows now for how many years? 3-4 years in this country. Why is she still complaining?
Well, I don't know. When you say the difference, I would say, is still pretty high because our inflation is very low. The difference between the rate of inflation of what, it's a percent and a half
well,
a year.
Well, I think
about interest rate.
Almost 2%, and you've got a prime now at, depending on where you go, at 5, 5.5. You've got real interest rates of 3 and 4%, and have had them for a number of years. Unprecedented lows for a significant period of time. If you think back to the early 1980s when interest rates went at some places in the high teens here in this country.
Yeah, 22% at one point.
Inflation at the same time was running 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% depending on when you looked at it. But the real rate of inflation or the real rate of interest was 10%, 11%, 12%. The difference between those two, now it's 3 and 4%.
Well, now, and I recall back to a little bit of economics that I took in university. They had said that an interest rate, a rate of return that you should receive for investing money, should be a matter of a couple of percent over inflation. We seem to have gotten used to this high rate of return, and what we've seen is an economy today where if you have money to invest, you make a lot of money.
But there isn't
if you
a high
work
rate
for a living,
return
you don't
today.
Make a.
There isn't a high return.
Well, a huge
today.
Rate of return. Look at the stock market. We've had record closes with the TSE for every month for the last 6 years.
You could lose it all tomorrow.
Yeah, but you're not. Statistically, that hasn't
happened. But we're not talking about buying stocks. We're talking about borrowing money. We're talking about that interest rate. You don't pay an interest rate when you buy a stock. You pay interest when you borrow money.
I know, but interest is a rate of return on money that you invest. But the other thing that she goes back to is she says that a reason why the federal government decided to abandon the fight against unemployment effectively was because the global economy wouldn't permit it. She said that if the Canadian government did anything dramatic about trying to reduce unemployment, then the global markets would effectively respond the way they did in Indonesia, for instance, where there was a huge flight of capital out of that country.
But didn't that happen here? Bob, help me here.
Well,
didn't that happen in 1980 here in this country?
I'm trying to grasp what Jeff's getting at here. Like, what's the solution in your mind, Jeff? I mean, what are you calling for here, and what is Linda McQuaid calling for?
Well, she
says there, if I look by the Free Press, we can solve our problems, quote, if we just tell the rich no more. Is that going to solve the problems of this country, is to tell the rich that, what, they can't have any more money? Is that what you're going to do, pass a law?
Well, that's part of it. One of the things that certainly happened in the way the economy is structured right now is that we have this huge disparity between rich and poor. As I've said, we've had a huge profitability in the market in the last several years. At the same time, the wages have been flat for the middle class. Real income for poor people has gone down dramatically. And yeah, she says that there's no reason why the rich have to keep getting richer. That's not a healthy thing for us as a society. I see in the Free Press today, it says that there's an article in the business section saying that the number of wealthy people in the world, that is people with more than $1 million U.S., is exploding
The issue is not the rich. The issue is the poor.
But in Canada,
it's a good thing to get more wealth and have more wealth, regardless of
where you get it. If you get it from your neighbor, that's not necessarily a good thing. In this case, in Canada,
it depends how you get it, not where you get it. It depends on whether you get it voluntarily through a consensual two-way, marketplace transaction, or whether you obtain it by force. It's not where you get it from, it's how you get it.
But in an economy that's static, where there's a fixed amount of wealth, nobody seriously suggests...
Pardon me, say that again? An economy that's static,
where there's a fixed amount
of
wealth.
What planet is that on?
Well,
can you show me the planet that there's such a thing? I don't know how you can say such a thing.
What I'm trying to do is to sort of frame this issue, but if you want to talk about an economy that's expanding, you can say that an expanding economy should only result in increasing wealth for the wealthy. I don't know how realistic that is either, but we can characterize it that way if you want. What it comes back to, again, is that right now, the way things are, is that we have this high unemployment. We have economists telling us that that's a good thing. We have to have this high rate of unemployment to kill inflation. Well, why do we want inflation?
The reason is because
we've got such profitability amongst people who have money to invest that would be very inflationary, but for the fact that the rest of us don't get pay raises, and the reason we don't get pay raises is because of high unemployment.
So the opposite to that is, okay, we should have more inflation, and I guarantee you that'll give you more unemployment.
Well, she identified a couple of things. One of them was this huge increase in the number of ultra-wealthy people. In Canada, Ernst & Young says since 1989, since the peak of our good times in the 80s, the number of millionaires has tripled.
So what?
So during the time of the recession, we tripled the number of millionaires we had. At the same time, we also saw child poverty going through the roof. We have this huge disparity where the rich are getting much richer, the poor are getting much poorer. We have to ask, is that a good, healthy thing for our society?
For the poor,
I would say it's not.
I would agree that people getting poorer is not a good thing, but whether you're middle class or poor or rich, everyone's objective is to be better off at the end of the day than at the beginning of the day.
And I've never suggested that people shouldn't go out and work hard and they should be rewarded for that.
How is stopping the rich from being rich going to help the poor? That's what I want to
figure out. Again, it's a question of where the money comes from.
Okay, let's pause for a moment here. We will continue with Left, Right, and Center and take your calls too. Lauren's waiting. He'll be up right after this.
Morning to you, Lauren.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, I have to take issue too with one of the gentlemen there, the one who said, what planet do you live on? Mm-hmm. I forget his name.
Bob Metz.
Bob, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was Bob, but I wanted to make sure before I said it.
Yeah.
Just anecdotally, I mean, I think the average wage earner is falling behind.
Well, I agree with that.
That's not what Bob was. That's not what he made his point in reference to, though. In fairness, Jeff had made a comment about a finite amount of wealth.
Yeah, he said that the economy is static, and I said,
can I just say something here? Do you think that the economy, that the way things are set up for the average wage earner? I don't believe that. I mean, how come stocks and stock transactions aren't taxed? What's the big deal with that?
Because they're not taxed until a profit or loss is gained or realized
at a point of sale.
Why not
just the transaction itself? Even like 0.5%, like that Tobin rule that has been proposed on the international scale.
Well,
money's flowing back and forth. If we're going to move to one economy, Why is it that,
Lauren,
can't be touched?
Lauren, hang on. You know, here you are. You're worried about how the average guy's falling behind, and the only thing you can see is adding another tax to somebody somewhere in society, which is the average guy. There's the reason why the average guy is falling behind, is because of the tax rate in Canada, which is one of the highest in the world.
Oh, so needless to say,
Canada does not have high taxes.
We'll rise up, and we'll all live in a great society.
But it's interesting that Linda McQuaig actually talks extensively about the Tobin tax that you've referred to, and that was the tax that was proposed back in 1972 by James Tobin, who's an economist at Harvard. And basically what he had said is that the main reason that governments can't control their own social policy and fiscal policy right now is because of the money traders and the speculation in the international market. And what he had proposed was the tax not to raise revenue, but to discourage transactions that were strictly for the purpose of speculation. And right now there are trillions of dollars every year that are changing hands.
Well, they're just going to throw the money away they raised?
No, he's saying that people won't make speculative transactions if they can't make money on it.
Yeah,
so what he's saying is that if you want to invest money in a country, you keep it there and then you'll pay a tiny tax. And he suggested a tiny tax. But the problem is that we've got people who are speculating and trading money hundreds of times a day. That would add up. And basically, his whole point was we have to discourage that in order that people invest in countries based on their real value and not on the hope that they can make a speculative buck.
May I just ask one question here?
Yes.
Or make an observation. I think the average person, all they want is a sense of fairness, that everyone is paying their fair share or their amount. Mm-hmm. And when you read about huge corporations not paying taxes and individuals, because of the way the tax taxes are set up, can funnel money and get high write-offs, etc., etc. I'd like you to discuss, if you could, a flat tax, 25%. If I have five jobs, I pay 25% of every penny I make, and that includes Bell Canada and Shell and Conrad Black and everybody else. What is wrong with that? And if there is something wrong with that, I really would like to know. I'll hang up and I'll listen to your discussion.
All right, thanks for the call, Lauren. And Lauren, you need to recognize this is Bob Metz who's going to respond to you now. He's the fellow you were concerned about his earlier comment.
No, I'm totally in favor of a flat tax. I've always advocated one, although the rate you suggest at 25% I think is exorbitant. I would suggest a flat tax of about 5 or 10% to basically fund what I regard as legitimate government functions. And then perhaps even move to a more voluntary and free tax system. But to add more taxes and to suggest that people who are speculating and working in the markets and stuff is just adding more confusion to the whole situation and taking more productivity out of the whole system. If I want to gamble with my money, I mean, that's basically what people are doing sometimes on the stock market, is that they're gambling and they haven't won or lost yet until they've sold those stocks. And yeah, they do pay taxes on it if they make money. It gets incorporated into their personal income.
Not if they have a good lawyer.
Well, and I think let's be clear about that issue too. And Jeff is a lawyer. There is no question that our tax code in this country is somewhat cumbersome. And there is also little question that with the right high-powered lawyers, you can avoid paying some taxes. But my research, and I've done a fairly extensive amount of research, suggests to me that the corporations are not getting away scot-free. They are paying significant amounts of taxes, and the shareholders of the corporation, this is where people think, corporation made $1 zillion and didn't pay any taxes. The corporation itself may not have, but all the profits that came out of that corporation were heavily taxed when they went to the people who collected the profits. And I just in the interest of fairness, I think people need to recognize that. There's a lot of talk about such and such a corporation made $1 million last year and didn't pay a dime. Well, that isn't because the law didn't make them pay the taxes they owed. Maybe they lost $1 million the year before and the two balanced out. These are the kinds of things, in a fair discussion, these are the kind of things we have to keep in mind.
But even the basic thinking to suggest that you've got to tax profits, which are the only place you're going to get jobs and equity and redistribution of wealth eventually through the marketplace, is just giving all the money to the government.
Okay, we're going to go back to the phones with caller Robert. Hello, Robert.
Hello. Jim, I just wanted to make some comments on some of the discussion so far. Number one, that the official U.S. rate of unemployment is maybe 4%, but I mean, I'm telling you, it's practically zero, because there's even in the New York Times there's help wanted.
Thick
as our newspaper.
Yeah, I've got a friend in Michigan who's opening a business in Michigan, and they can't find people to work there.
That's right.
They can't find them.
What I'd like to say is that I think the creation of more wealth by whoever, whether it's rich or poor, is always a good thing.
Of course.
And I'd like to characterize Jeff's view on this as what I describe as the politics of envy, where they're always, in an envious position of anyone that, that does well, whether it's a company or a person. And you know, my point about Jeff is he's saying, well, you know, it depends where the money comes from, but like, so he's implying that the money is coming from the poor. But this, how can that be? Because by definition, the poor don't have any money. So how can the rich make their money on the backs of the poor?
I guess one of the questions is whether you think that's the way it should be, that we should have a status, a class, or a caste in our society of poor who have no money. Is
well,
that a
no,
healthy society?
That's not a thing that's determined by, it shouldn't be determined by government policy. It should be determined by individuals. But the other thing, of my comment on your definition of, you know, that speculation should be taxed. But, you know, then you run into the problem of, well, who's going to determine what speculation is and what it isn't? And then you've got another whole government system interfering in what should essentially be private enterprise and a voluntary enterprise between individuals in the society.
Well, we already have heavy regulation in relation to the stock market, for instance. There's all kinds of speculation that's not permitted. Junk bonds are a good example that were effectively shut down in the United States. So we already have substantial
right,
regulation of speculation because we recognize that unbridled speculation can be bad.
Yes, and I'm not saying there's not rules for there's not a government policy in forming some regulations. But what you're talking about is wholeheartedly, you know, redistributing money from one end of the economic scale to the other by government fiat.
Yeah, and the question is whether it's better to make sure that we have a whole class of people who literally do have nothing, and realistically they don't right now, because we have a socialistic
right
country
there,
where they get welfare checks every month. They don't have nothing. We decide how much they're going to get as a society. But the question is, ultimately, what kind of city do you want to live in? What kind of country do you want to live in? I'd like to live in one where people get along and people don't sort of feel the need to have people who have millions and millions and millions of dollars in a city next to a bunch of people who have virtually nothing. And to say that the millions and millions of millions of dollars have been created out of thin air and have not been taken from other people effectively, but what they could contribute to society, is just a pipe dream. Realistically, we have
a certain amount
of resources in our country, but what we've seen over the last number of years is not that the poor are staying static and the rich are getting much richer because they're a lot smarter.
But
we're seeing the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. I think there's a causal relationship there.
The politics of envy. That's what I described that whole argument as, and I just don't buy it. I don't think that a person's economic well-being should be, you know, you're always saying we should determine and we're this and we're that. I think all those things that you're talking about is it can only be accomplished by government dictate. And what I'm saying is that a society should be free for individuals and businesses to do their business without a third-party government sticking their neck in it and determining, you know, who's wealthy and who shouldn't be and,
Robert,
you know, all this kind of stuff.
Appreciate your call today. Thank you,
okay,
sir.
Okay, thanks.
Just like to point out, I just came from a country where there are no rich and poor. Everybody's poor. 643-1290. Andrew joins us. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, guys.
Yes, sir.
I'm with Bob on this one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the poor people have to realize that, you know, they've got to learn how to invest and how to handle their own money. Like the first thing they do, they get out of school or something, they run up such huge debt. Like isn't Canada have now, like what was it, Visa or someone did a study with $64 billion in debt on credit?
Mm-hmm.
And like there's not very many people have much in savings accounts anymore.
I think they're into a huge debt before they get out of school in most cases nowadays.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the problem with that? Again, we come back to that old argument. So what?
Well, again, it's a question of what kind of society do you want to have? Do you want to have a society where only wealthy people can send their kids to university? Again, we go back to an aristocracy system, which we had in Europe in the 1700s.
No.
Is that a better system?
Do you want a system where only the rich people can open a little business? I mean,
I would say it's a system where the people who are the smartest, the hardest working should get ahead. That's the problem, is that when we get away from that, we get into the system where if you're wealthy,
how are we
money to invest,
how are we
if you have money to invest, then you make a huge amount of money.
If you're smart and hard working,
that's not money based on hard work. It's money based on the fact that you have money. Right now, if you have money, you make money on your investments.
But that doesn't mean that smart, hardworking people can't get ahead. That's what they aspire to. That's why they work hard.
Oh, sure it is. What's happening is we end up with a system like the Ivy League in the United States where you can't go to university unless you're wealthy. Realistically, that's the system that they have. Is that the best system? I would suggest not. What we want is to have our best and brightest getting our most education to make our society as
don't they do that now?
Rich as we can. Oh, no. What's happening in Canada is we're getting, when I went to university, my tuition for law school was about $700 a year. Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays we're moving to the MBA, and I had applied for MBA at the same, or yeah. HBA at the same time, same thing. Mm-hmm. Within the next 2 years, the tuition's going to be $20,000 a year. Mm-hmm. That is going to shut out a lot of people. And if you think that the Ontario Student Loan Program is going to come in to help them, it won't.
Well,
dramatically underfunded.
Well, it needs to, doesn't it? Are we not agreeing on that?
Sure.
But the fact that that isn't going to do it, that's not a reason to not put those things up to market value, to put that education to market value. That's a failure on the part of the government to provide the financing to do it.
But if the government can't do it right, it shouldn't do it.
Well, I won't argue that. We appreciate the call today.
All right, thank you,
sir. And we have Robert waiting. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Jim.
Yes, sir.
I guess, like your previous callers, I'm with Bob on this one. I'm a small businessman. I would consider myself to be lower middle class, if not poor, depending on how you want to look at it and what I can afford. I have a couple of observations based on your discussion. First is that as a businessman, as a person trying to make a living, there's only two things in my mind which determine whether or not I'm successful. Mm-hmm. That is my willingness to work and the government intrusiveness in my business. Those two things determine how successful I am.
Mm-hmm.
Your previous caller, Robert, had an interesting comment about the politics of greed or envy, I think he said. And I've seen this before in Linda McQuaig's articles in the papers, and that is the hatred of the rich for being rich.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an attempt, I think, for Linda McQuaig to help the poor. It's simply an attempt to get the rich. I particularly am...
It's Marxism, Robert. It's
Marxism.
But it's astounding that you would suggest that somebody who thinks that we should all live a bit more modestly and so that other people don't starve is greedy, whereas a person who says, no, I should take as much as I possibly can from my city or my country, I should suck as much wealth as I possibly can out of it, that person is not greedy. And
he's
to suggest that envy
wealth,
is the only reason why you have a problem with that, I would suggest that most people would say that's just not fair.
It's interesting, Jeff. It's interesting the motives that you're putting on rich people. I want to be rich myself. I don't think there's anybody out there who doesn't want to be rich. And
yeah.
I think the motivation for that is to help people. I have a product to sell. I bend over backwards trying to please my customers, trying to do what's right for them. Otherwise, I don't make a dime.
So you say the only reason you want to be rich is to help people?
Being rich is the product of helping people.
Okay, wouldn't people be helped more if you weren't rich, if you handed your wealth over to other people? Wouldn't that help them even more? If your goal is to help people, surely you can do that better. I was interested, though, when you said that the only things that are going
to
affect the wealth...
How am I supposed to help people by giving them things that they don't earn?
I was interested that you said that the only things that that relate to your wealth is how hard you work, and I can't remember the other one, but it occurs to me that you didn't mention anything about...
Intrusiveness of government.
Right. You don't mention the state of the economy at all. Is it your experience that your business is absolutely as successful at the pit of a depression as it is in the height of good economic times? Like, I think that there's a lot more to it than that.
Well, no, that's why you perhaps forgot my other side of the coin, which was the intrusiveness of government. Because I think that what's driving economies is the willingness of people to work and the intrusiveness of government. How they mismanage the economy, how they inflate currencies by printing too much money, how they put up barriers across borders. 3/4 of my business is in the States and Japan.
So if we didn't have governments, we wouldn't have depressions? Is this what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying we shouldn't have governments, Jeff. I'm saying that governments should be relegated to the prime function, which is the removal of force from society. And it's exactly the opposite that Linda McQuaig is advocating. She's advocating we use force on those people who, in her estimation, have received their millions on the backs of the poor.
But anything that I've ever heard about business is that there is a cycle to business, that it's not that a government chooses to suddenly put an economy into recession or anything, that there is a cycle in ebb and flow.
Well, that's
one of the factors of
it's a
maybe
theory.
Not. Maybe business would be, you know, if business ran our world, maybe we would have nothing but prosperity for everybody. But I just find it very hard to believe that. And I don't understand why somebody like Matthew Barrett or somebody would say, I'd like to double my salary this year because I can. You know, I made $2 million last year, but I'd like to make $4 million this year. And I'd like to raise service fees. I'd like to to keep interest rates as high as I can. I would like to not lend money to small businesses because they're risky.
But that's not a business decision he's making. He is protected by the government because of the monopoly position of the banks. That's a governmental problem, not a business
problem. Well, the government
problem.
Hasn't told me I have to double your salary this year.
No,
the government hasn't said you have to raise your user fees.
The government has said you don't have any competition. That's what the government has said.
But that's another problem.
We do not have open competition in banks in this country.
Well, and we
if we did, if we did, Matthew Barrett would not be doubling his salary. I guarantee it.
Well, you know something? From my perspective, if I said the same thing, that I'm going to make twice as much this year as I did last, I'd have to work twice as hard, or I'd have to think twice as quick.
But I think, I think Jeff's point is a good one on that, though, that he doesn't, all he has to do is say, I'm going to take more money, because the power behind that bank, the ownership of that bank, is so diffuse that they have no power.
Well,
but again,
I don't know this person, but if he's in control of a bank, he's part of the government problem.
Oh, I don't think the government would be associated with that.
Because we don't have a free market in banking.
No, we don't.
If we did, wouldn't have the
what
you would.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, the point I was trying to make is I don't think it matters. Matthew Barrett is a business problem. It is a governmental problem.
Yes.
If open the banks up to competition, if Matthew Barrett can convince his shareholders in a competitive market that he's worth twice as much money, then more power to him. I submit to you he will not be able to convince him of that, but because of the Canadian government policies, he doesn't have to. All he has to do is write the check. Appreciate the call, Robert.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. We have to pause for a moment. We'll be back with more Talk of the Town, left, right, and center after this. Interesting edition this morning of Left, Right, and Center with Bob Metz and Jeff Schlemmer. We've been talking about the premise behind Linda McQuaig's book. Her latest book is called The Cult of Impotence. It's a Canadian bestseller, selling the myth of powerlessness in the global economy. She basically says that we're kidding ourselves, and Paul Martin has kidded us, and we can do whatever we want economically, and we've been discussing that this morning. I want to kind of clear the page for just a second here, guys, and maybe look at this in a historical perspective. Jeff, you raised the question during the commercial, what kind of country, where do we want to be 100 years from now, 50 years from now, if the rich continue to get richer and the poor continue to get poorer? I know Linda addresses this in the book, but the point has been made by economists, and I've read writing about this too, that 100 years ago the disparity was even greater than it is today. So for those who suggest that we're moving in the wrong direction, there are equal numbers who say no. In fact, even though, yes, there's a tiny handful of people who are incredibly wealthy, there always have been, and the poor are much better off than they've been at any time in history.
What she says is that, 100 years ago we had England under the gold standard, and at that time there were these huge disparities during the latter part of the Industrial Revolution. She says that what changed that was effectively the two world wars, and she says that that forced England, which was sort of the world power of the day, to get off the gold standard and get away from kowtowing all the time to the money traders, effectively. And she said that when that happened, that caused the disparity between the rich and poor to lessen right up until the 60s. But in the 60s, the trend started to change the other way, and through the 70s, that the disparities have become more pronounced. So she said, that the gap between the rich and poor did become less right up until the 60s, but that now it's growing again.
Do you buy that, Bob?
I have an interesting question to ask, Jeff, and it's because of your visit to Cuba. You just told us before the ads that in Cuba they don't have any disparities. Everybody's poor. So, Jeff, there's your ideal society. There's no disparity there. Even the minister of the government is poor.
I would suggest that this is something that they're working on. But the next question earlier on was, how do people feel about that? How upset are they right now? And are you happier living in a society where you have your boss making 100 times what you do? Does that make you happier or less happy? I would suggest it makes you less happy. I'd suggest there's a lot of differences between Cuba and Canada in terms of our technological development.
Isn't that what the previous caller said? That
hey, sticks and stones will break my bones. I don't know why you have to use the word envy. Why is it that the only reason you could possibly to be disturbed that somebody is taking in huge amounts of money, way, way, way more than they work for, the only reason that could possibly bother you is
envy.
The only
way that can
happen.
Listen,
I don't set out each morning to try and rob from my neighbor if I possibly can. That doesn't make me envious.
Let me tell you something interesting about Cuba. I'm probably going to talk about this a lot for the next few weeks because it's so foremost in my mind, and there's so many things that relate to our society. Jeff raises a very good point, Rob. In Cuba, everybody is more or less the same. I had lunch with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Havana and went to his home. And he lives in a very modest home by our standards. There are Cubans whose homes I visited who were much less nice than his, mind you, so there is still some level of disparity, but not very much. And he makes no more than, some of the street vendors make more money than he does. I have to tell you, though, Bob, and Jeff raised the question, they were even the poorest people I talked to were relatively happy.
Well, I said that during the commercial, too. I said I know a lot of poor people who are who are happy. And Jeff said, how far can we allow this disparity to go? In a free society, it will become almost infinite.
But they weren't happy because they were poor. They were happy because they recognized that even though they were poor, so was everybody else.
It's a question of fairness. They perceive themselves as being treated, you know, more or less like everybody else.
Well, if you want fairness and equality, the only way you're going to get that through the state is to end up with a Cuba. Everybody's going to be poor. They're all the same. They're all poor. There's no hope for advancement, and that's the style of life you're going to accustom
yourself to. Well, Norway's another example.
From cradle to grave. Is that the society you want to live in?
In Norway right now, the average chief executive salary is about three times what the average salary of the average worker is.
Why do you keep talking about rich people? I want to talk about the poor.
Told me that the only alternative is Cuba and poverty. I would suggest that Norway is an affluent Nordic country. They've done very well, but they haven't chosen to go the route of having ultra rich. They haven't chosen to just sit back and say to people, if you can rob my pocket, more power to you. I'll just sit back and envy you.
I come back to my question, Jeff. If we were sitting in Cuba right now, the three of us, what would you and Linda McQuaig be telling the poor?
Well,
would you be even worried about it? Probably not. You'd be quite happy.
I would suggest
no disparity.
That, well, right off the bat, you're talking about a third world country compared, and you won't talk about Norway for some reason that I haven't figured out yet.
Well, because you're talking about rich people. You're always talking about rich people. You're constantly
because I envy them, apparently.
Well, apparently you do. But you do that in the name of helping the poor, and yet you don't even want to talk about the poor. Okay, here we got a country that's completely poor. Everybody's poor. We're all equally poor. We've got no disparity. We're all equal.
There are lots
now,
of right-wing poor countries in the third world
country.
As well. What's the
how
difference?
How will we get some wealth into that country? How would you start?
Well, I'd say the Kretschmann going down there is a start. You know, there's no reason why they can't develop into a socialist model like Sweden, like Norway, like any of the other countries
saying?
That try
Canada
to base their
money to
distribution
Cuba?
Of wealth on fairness. There's nothing wrong with suggesting to them you can get technological development,
well, what's more fair
development,
than
you can get
getting
industrial
the wealth
development,
that you create?
Social development. They're a third world country. That's why they're poor.
Jeff,
they're left wing is not the reason for that. There are lots of very poor right wing countries too in the third world.
Do you assume that wealth just exists in nature? That it just sits there and then it's just there to be redistributed?
Well, wealth is a function of the natural resources that we have, of our industry, of our education, of all kinds of
things.
All
that is people.
And entrepreneurialism, that's
all
one of the factors.
All that is people. And
but if we had a country that had no natural resources, we'd have no wealth.
That's not true. There's a lot of countries that have very few natural resources.
Japan's the only one I can think of.
Well, even as an example, what were they doing right in the respect of that? They saw their natural resources, quote, being people.
But I don't think you or I have ever disagreed about whether people should get ahead if they work hard. You know, and people should get ahead if they're smart.
Yeah, but
the
not
question
too
is, far how
ahead.
Far ahead?
That's right.
Should there be an unlimited horizon that
yes,
they can take
absolutely.
Everything that everybody else has
absolutely
if they're smart
there
enough?
Should be.
And you can posit a person who is such a hard
it's
worker and such a smart guy
otherwise.
That he can get everything. Is that the kind
not
of society you want to live in? I'd say no, I don't like that society. I like a society that's fair.
I heard you describe a typical rich person as somebody who sucks the wealth out of the poor. Well,
no, I didn't. I've never said
or
that.
Out of society or out of the middle. Yeah, you said sucks the wealth.
I believe you said that this morning.
That's exactly the term you used. And that to me tells me how you think about wealth. You know, like say I'm a rich newspaper mogul or something like that. I don't get wealthy by sucking the wealth out of people. I get wealthy by sucking the little nickels and dimes out of them, the little things that give them something greater for that little nickel or dime than what they spent. And because all of those dimes accumulate around my effort, I become rich.
If
I did
the economy
not make
is one where rich people get richer and poor people don't get any poorer and middle class people don't get any poorer, I would agree with you, but that's not the world we live in.
I need a question answered from both of you guys.
Sure.
When talking about the rich getting richer, as though they have a vault somewhere and they're putting in a pile of gold and they're
just filling
exactly.
I honestly believe half the population thinks that's what wealth
well,
is about.
Jeff, I want to ask you when somebody does get richer and richer, Matthew Barrett, for example, what do you think that money does? Has he got a money vault somewhere? What does he do with his money?
Well, his money probably goes to the Cayman Islands, and he's got a good Canadian lawyer who will make sure that he doesn't have to pay any tax on it. What he'll probably do is have a lot of it invested in stocks, which have seen huge increases over the last number of years. He'll have a lot of it invested in, he probably will be playing a variety of different things, but one of them will be money speculation.
Sure, but that money in the stock, so he buys some stocks then. When he buys that stock, what happens? What does that enable? Is that just a piece of paper he buys?
No. But if you buy a stock, it means you're giving money to a company. The company can use
to
the money however they want. They
to
can
do
choose
what?
To invest in infrastructure if they want, or research, or they can pay it out in a dividend. They can do whatever they want with it. In Canada, we don't put much into research.
Well, they don't pay their investments out in dividends. Your company doesn't last very long if you do that.
But they can. You know, if you're buying stock in a company, you're buying ownership of the company, and the management will decide what happens to it.
Well, stock sales, it better be coming from your profits.
Well, Bob, I want to ask you the same question now. Where do you think his money goes? What does he do with it?
Well, the money money does not sit static in a mattress somewhere or in a Scrooge McDuck vault where it just sits for somebody to use it. If it did, it would have no value and it wouldn't be working in the economy. Money, all money is constantly being churned through the economy doing work. What that company does with that investment is invest it in either capital, which you need in order for labor to be productive. It may invest it in the labor, it may hire more people, but that money gets used for productive purposes, which in turn creates more wealth, which is why the so-called rich seem to be getting richer, because they are generating that wealth. They're not taking it from someone else, they are creating it. The idea that all the skyscrapers in North America and all the wealth that exists in this country existed forever and ever is an absolute farce. I mean, 200 years ago, there wasn't a single skyscraper. If that wealth was already there, how did the skyscrapers come into existence?
There's a lot more gold in the ground. There's a lot more oil in the ground and a lot more trees on the ground.
Those things aren't made out of gold and oil and
trees. They're
made
out
of different things.
Money is just a symbol that represents something you have or could have. That's all it is.
Well, it basically represents the amount of productivity that you've contributed to society, basically. And that's one way that we measure it. Money's not the only way, but it's certainly the way that we measure, you know, our interrelationship of economically.
Okay, one of the ways we measure our economic success here in the radio station is by communicating with you important messages from our sponsors, and here are some. I would be remiss if I didn't make some mention of what's happening later today that you're involved with the alternative, or what's the terminology for the budget? Alternative budget.
Yeah.
Can you just give us a quick thumbnail of what that's all about?
Sure. Yeah, within the last 3 or 4 years, there's a group of economists and other folks who have gotten together to prepare an alternative budget, both for the federal budget and for the provincial budget each year. And they usually release it a week or so prior to the government's budget coming out. So today we're releasing the provincial budget. And what the budget does basically is pose alternatives for people to remind them that we have choices about the way that government spends money. And so with respect to the provincial budget today, there are a variety of things that they're saying we could do differently. And again, these are economists who prepare it. I don't purport to know the details of how they work it through. But one of the things that the biggest points that they make or that struck me was they said that if my carrots had been stuck away in a closet for the last 3 years, then our deficit would be gone a year sooner than it will be with him being in government. And the main reason for that is the tax cut. And they talk about the tax cut and how their research shows that 60% of the money that is involved in the tax cut is being paid to or is not being asked for from the highest 20% of wage earners in Ontario, and effectively it's a huge redistribution of wealth that 60% when it was taken in taxes and spent in social services would have been distributed presumably proportionally.
So they discount the potential effects of that money in terms of reinvestment in creating the new jobs that have created this prosperity that they agree. It's been the prosperity in the province that has moved things along, not Mike Harris.
Well, it's striking that I had to go back and I've dusted off my Common Sense Revolution to have a look at it, and it's interesting that when the government proposed the tax cut, they said this tax cut is going to weaken our economy. It's going to take money out of the economy, and in fact, they had set up a $650 million fund to cope with some of the effects of the deflationary effect in the economy. And the reason for it, they said, was that they recognized that when that money was in the hands of government, every penny of it was going out. Every penny that went into welfare, for instance, in London, was paid to a London landlord for rent, was paid to a London shopkeeper for groceries and so on. And they themselves acknowledged, Mark Mullen was the name of the economist who drafted this part of the Common Sense Revolution at U of T. He said, you know, when we hand a big chunk of this money over to wealthy people, they're not going to invest it into our community because these are people who don't need to. These are people whose lifestyle is such that they don't need extra money to live on. What they'll do is they'll invest it. And again, if they have good lawyers, they won't be investing it in Ontario. They'll be investing it offshore because they won't pay tax on it that way. So they recognized that the tax cut was going to prevent job creation in Ontario. And in fact, I've got an article from Jeff Rubin, chief economist at CIBC Wood Gundy, who said that the biggest impediment in economic recovery in Ontario, the biggest thing preventing us from having the same recovery the United States is having, has been the tax cut.
Do you believe that? This is the same one of these bank guys that you're mad at for making all this money.
They're the only ones who have the time to research this stuff.
How can you even say that they're taking money out of the economy? The economy
I'm just telling you what
that.
The economists are telling you.
Well, then dismiss those economists immediately, because if they're telling you they're taking money out of the economy, where is it going if it's outside the economy? That's like saying...
That's it. It's gone to the Cayman Islands.
But that's still in the economy. It's in the
world
economy.
Not our economy.
So you mean specifically The Canadian economy, so you're worried about foreign investment.
Why no, I'm worried about Ontarians taking money that right now is spent in Ontario and instead choosing to spend it in the Cayman Islands. That's
yeah,
what they said.
Lower taxes, right?
I happen to agree with
so
what they're saying, but this isn't my idea. This is their idea. So you've got Jeff Rubin.
So we need lower taxes.
You've got Mark Mullen.
That's the argument.
Mark Mullen had said as well that the thesis upon which he had posited the tax cut was to say that at the same time there shouldn't be government spending cuts. If there are government spending cuts, then effectively that again worsens the drag. Now our economy is doing well, and the reason it's doing well is that we have an industrial economy that's heavily based on exports to the United States. The States is doing extremely well, so we're doing well, but we're not doing as well as they are. Our unemployment still is up at around 8%. And when you think about it, you know, we've had 3 years now of Tory government, and I think about, forget about the poor. We know the poor are much worse off. We know the rich are much better off.
Well,
but how is the middle class doing? And has
that.
The middle class, we've had 3 years now of economic prosperity. Is the middle class getting raises right now? Are things generally better for them than they were 3 years ago? And for the average person, I know they're not. They're putting their kids in private schools because they've lost confidence
but
in
that
schools.
Will come.
They can't
if
get their kids cared for in
if
hospitals.
We don't vote ourselves
we've got street
out of
people
the
that we didn't have 3 years ago.
Before we get the benefits of the cure that we've been going through. You know, the
cure is worse than the disease, I suggest.
Well, that's not so. You know, this has been always one of the problems with the political cycle. When you want to fix a problem, for example, that the Ray government caused, the beneficiaries of fixing that problem won't happen until maybe one or two governments past Mike Harris. That's when we're going to see the results, unless we change our minds again because we're tired of taking the cure.
Again, that was the theory about the massive increases in interest rates back in the late 80s, was we were going to kill inflation for all time, and ultimately it was tough medicine, but it would be good for our economy, and it didn't happen. They overdid it. They overkilled the economy, and we've been paying the price of that ever since.
Well, there's always an argument of too far, too fast, but I dismiss that argument because it's still a matter of direction. That's what we're talking about here, is which direction do you go in? And I think the issue is that you have to have lower taxes. And I think that whether the top 20% of people want that money or not, is really not the issue.
But it comes back to fairness.
Taxes is what I would call taking the money out of the economy.
Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Jeff, you're suggesting people should read this book.
Yeah, it's a good book. Very
Bob,
readable.
Do you think they shouldn't, or should they read it? And
I think they should so that they can understand Marxism as it's applied to the Canadian economy.
All right, it's Linda McQuaid's book. It's called The Cult of Impotence. It's been discussed this morning by Robert Metz and Jeff Schlemmer, my guests, as they are every Wednesday on Left, Right, and Center. Thank you, gentlemen. A pleasure. Great to be back today. Good show today.
Thank you, Jim.
We'll see you again a week from today, and we'll see you tomorrow. Tomorrow we have a number of guests with us. We got a bunch of open phones, too. We're going to be talking about, among other things, diversification in sexuality, dealing with stress in the workplace, men's role in society today. Is it as bad off as some men would like us to think? All this, open phones, and a lot more on the next edition of Talk of the Town. For Jeff and Bob, for Ryan and Tara, it's Jim saying it's great to be back. You have no idea how lucky we are to live where we do. We'll see you tomorrow.